Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. Well, there was an event last night. Did anybody stay up and watch that? The presidential debates were last night, and we'll spend the first hour talking about it. Joining us today will be Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College, and Steve Terry, WCAX Political Analyst, will join us to share their take on the debate. And then we'll open up the phone lines and have you share your opinions on the debate as well. And then in the second hour, after we check in with our colleagues at Talk Media News, I want to change it up a bit. We just lost poet David Budhill on Sunday. But in the first part of September, we lost another poet, Northeast Kingdom poet Leland Kingsley. And he's a seventh generation Vermonter who wrote so beautifully about Vermont, including its nature and our life in this state. D.D. Cummings, she's the publisher of Leland's poetry. She'll join us to tell us who Leland Kinsey was and why it's important for us to know and remember him. And then, if we get some time, we'll open up the phone lines again and continue our discussion on presidential debates. So let's get started about the presidential debates. Joining me on the phone this morning is our friend Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Mike.
Every time I watch debates, I think Donald Trump loses a debate, and yet every time after the debate, his poll numbers usually go up. Will they this time?
No, I don't think so. What we know, Mike, about debates from at least from previous election cycles is debates serve much more to reinforce the perceptions that voters had when they turned on the debate rather than to change all that many minds. So I think what's going to happen in terms of the poll numbers after last night's debate is the race had been tightening. Clinton had been slipping for the past couple of weeks. I think that's going to basically stop, and the race is going to basically freeze, I think, until the next debate. With, if you look at the average of the polls, Clinton ahead by a small amount, but not outside the margin of error. And a lot of the big states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, very much still open for grabs. So I think that's where we're going to end up. Now, last night's debate didn't help Trump in the sense that the way he came across, I think, solidified his support among his base, particularly white men, older white men who did not go to college. I think he has that group pretty much locked up, and according to some polls, perhaps by as much as a 3-1 margin. But what Trump needs in order to really be ahead in some of these swing states is he needs to get more college-educated voters, and he needs to be doing better among women. And I don't think last night's debate is going to help him with either of those constituencies.
As you mentioned, where he has the problem is college-educated white voters that normally are up for grabs for the GOP. And actually, Mitt Romney had them in large numbers over Barack Obama in 2012. He needs to get those. But last night, as you observed, he didn't seem to reach out to those. What does he do? What does he need to do to reach out to those?
Well, the first thing he needs to do for the next debate, he needs to be much better prepared than he was last night. Now, the next debate is the one where it's audience questions. So you never know what you're going to expect in that situation. I think it's the Gallup organization who selects the audience. It's about 200 undecided voters, and, you know, maybe 10 to 20 of them will get the chance to ask a question. But Trump needs to spend a lot more time rehearsing. He needs to be sure of his responses. He needs to be more grounded in the facts than he was last night. At the same time, Clinton has to avoid overconfidence. She obviously prepared very hard for last night. She needs to do the same for the second debate. And the second debate, because it is questions from the audience, that's the one that demands sort of somewhat more empathy from the candidates for the questioners. Now, that's the famous debate, for example, back in 92, when a woman whose brother, had lost his job, asked Bill Clinton a question about unemployment. He walked up to her and he said, "Ma'am, I feel your pain." Mm-hmm. And at the same time, George H.W. Bush was looking at his watch. So Clinton needs to show some empathy and connection with voters in the setting that the second debate will be.
Hillary, before the debate, it was said that she needed to reach out to millennials. I'm not sure she did last night. Maybe she's given up on them. What's your thoughts on that?
That's a good question, Mike, and I was wondering something related to that. Bernie Sanders is campaigning with Clinton later this week in New Hampshire. The event is in Manchester. In my view, the Clinton campaign could be using Sanders a lot better. His core support in the primaries was clearly younger voters, people under 35. I think what Clinton should be doing is sending Bernie off to some of the big college towns and some of the swing states to campaign for him there and make the argument that with the election so close, a vote for Jill Stein in practice is a vote for Donald Trump. They should be sending him, the Clinton campaign should be sending Bernie to places like Ann Arbor in Michigan, Madison in Wisconsin, some of the college towns in Pennsylvania, to make the argument with young voters that with the stakes so high and the race so close, this is not the election in which you should be voting for a third-party candidate who has no chance of winning.
What was the most effective tactic used by Clinton last night?
I think just letting Trump be himself. Letting him go on and ramble, and she occasionally got some good digs in on him, like on the taxes and on some of his past business practices, and he sort of walked into some of the traps that she set for him. Obviously, she had prepared some of those lines, when he criticized her for not campaigning enough, and she says, "Well, I've been preparing," and then she said, "I wasn't just preparing for the debate. I was preparing to be president." That was obviously a rehearsed line, which he was just waiting for the right opportunity to use.
I thought in the beginning Trump may have had her on her heels a bit on trade, but he seemed to meander after that. It seemed like he was a one-trick pony.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, clearly, and I think polls indicate this, the issue of trade is something that he is pretty strong at. Now, one can disagree with him on the facts and the way he analyzes trade, but trade deals aren't popular now among wide swaths of voters. But the economy is complex, and just ranting on about trade doesn't necessarily answer the question, which Lester Holt tried to get Trump to answer, which is, how are you going to bring back jobs? Give some specific examples of things that you will do that will lead to the creation of new jobs. And Trump really wasn't able to answer that, and he hasn't been able to answer it in the campaign so far, other than saying, "I'm a great negotiator and we'll come up with new trade deals."
Enthusiasm is what Clinton needs to achieve, and especially to bring out the African-American vote, enthusiasm that they had in 2008 for Barack Obama. But also, Donald Trump needs to show he's capable to run the country. Did either of them achieve those objectives last night?
I think Clinton is getting closer on the African-American voters, and it may be more reaction against Trump than anything Clinton says. Trump didn't help himself with African-American voters with the way he responded to the moderator's questions about race. His immediate answer was law and order, and then he gave some statistics about crime, which just aren't accurate. So I think Clinton will get to the African-American, the African-American voters will come around, and that's a place where you can use surrogates too. President Obama himself and other elected African-American leaders, members of Congress, and so forth. In terms of being prepared to be president, I don't think Trump really helped himself in that. I mean, one of the things that's clear about being president, and this is not a partisan thing, it applies to George W. Bush, it applies to Barack Obama, it applies to everyone who's held that office. Now, I've read a lot of memoirs by presidents and people who worked with them, and one of the things that comes things through clear from all these memoirs, it's a very difficult job. There's a lot of meetings, a lot of reading, a lot of preparation, a lot of hard thinking needed. And Trump hasn't given evidence so far that that's his style. You know, he boasts about not reading much and not preparing for things and getting information about foreign policy from Sunday TV shows and things like that.
As you mentioned at the outset, those Hillary Clinton supporters are still going to be Hillary Clinton supporters no matter what happens at the debate. Those Donald Trump supporters are going to be Donald Trump supporters no matter what happens at the debate. But they're all going after different constituencies. Between now and the next debate, what do they sort of have to do in the next debate in order to sort of woo people? Or is it all over after the first debate?
No, I don't think it's all over by any means. I mean, the next debate is, I believe it's Sunday the 9th, so it's a little less than 2 weeks off. But first of all, both of them need to take time off from campaigning to prepare. Second, I think Trump needs to have much more thoroughly fleshed out answers to questions about jobs and taxes and trade, not just rely on the same sort of lines that he uses in his big rallies. Clinton needs to demonstrate empathy with voters, and I think Clinton in particular will be focusing on trying to solidify her support among these college-educated white voters by making the case that she's a steady pair of hands and that Trump is too much of a risk in the office of the presidency.
We have talked about state politics and how the number of people that will come out in a presidential year is quite substantially more than in a non-presidential year. What does any of this debate or presidential election this year, will it have an impact on statewide office? Let's take governor's race, for example.
Yeah, it might, Mike. And my thinking has more to do with turnout than it does with who's going to win. I'm pretty sure that Hillary Clinton will win in Vermont. I don't think she'll necessarily win by as big as a margin as Barack Obama did. He was in the mid-60s, even close to 70% in 2008 and 2012. I think Hillary Clinton will be more like John Kerry, which is in the high 50% range, maybe even get up to 60. But how big will the turnout be? Obama's elections had very high turnout in Vermont, over 70% or close to 70%. I'm not sure the turnout's going to be quite that high this year, maybe more in the mid-60s. But again, we'll see. I mean, we do have a competitive open governor's race, so that'll drive some voters to the polls. The turnout's going to be high. Will it be as high as the last two? I'm not so sure. And what about people who are thinking now of Gary Johnson or Jill Stein? Are they going to continue with those 30 third-party candidates or move into the camp of one of the two major party candidates? At the margin, I think a higher turnout in the presidential election year is a slight benefit to Democratic candidates in Vermont. So if they turned out 65 rather than 70%, that might make the electorate leaning slightly more in a Phil Scott direction, but that's only at the margin. I think the governor's race is going to be decided much more by voters' perceptions of the candidates, how those perceptions get framed by news coverage, by the advertising campaigns. That will be very intense. I think Vermont voters are going to see, since this state isn't really considered a toss-up state presidentially, we're going to see far more ads in the governor's race than we're going to see in the presidential race.
Eric Davis, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Mike.
Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College. Coming up, Steve Terry, WCAX Political Analyst, will talk again about the presidential debate last night. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have on the phone line Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Mike.
You know, we've done a couple of presentations at various locations around the state together. One of the things that I'm always amazed about is that when I look at a debate with Donald Trump in there, I always come away thinking he didn't do all that well, and yet his poll numbers keep going up. Do debates make a difference?
Well, yes, and I think that in this debate, we may have seen the first time, and I know This is very dangerous to predict, but I think the Trump always upward movement may well have peaked as a result of last evening. Now, why do I say that? I think it was the very nature of this debate. I mean, for 90 minutes, you had a split screen of both of these candidates, and you could not help but be impacted as a viewer to watch as the debate went on, the obvious discomfort and strategies that Trump tried to use this time, much like he did in previous debates, but they did not, in my judgment, work for him this time. He came across as ill-prepared. He seemed to be almost not focused on what the question was, which is a strategy, but his answers, especially in the last half, were very weak. On the other hand, I thought Hillary Clinton, who may have started off a bit slow, especially on the trade issue, but as time went on in that debate, she really, really grew stronger. And frankly, Mike, I think she ended with a smashing punch to Donald Trump's face in her last answer on the women's issue.
One of the things I was thinking of as I was watching this debate is that if I'm somebody sitting in Ohio or Michigan or on another state where I may have lost my job because the company has moved out and gone overseas, doesn't what Donald Trump say appeal to me?
Yes, especially on the trade issue. But you know, and no question, that he probably scored some early points there. But you know, Mike, I think the question and answer that will linger in people's mind is at the point that she almost got him to say, not quite, that he has not paid taxes. And basically, his answer was paying zero income tax, quote, that makes me smart. Well, you know, every hard-working American and Vermonter I know probably has to pay taxes. I think he lost a lot of ground with that rather flip, arrogant answer.
One of the things that Hillary Clinton needs to do is attract millennials. She's been having a lot of problems with millennials. She didn't seem to be outwardly going after them last night. Does she have a different tactic?
Well, the only thing that I heard her say was speaking about higher education and going to college debt-free. I did notice last night that Bernie Sanders was interviewed by MSNBC, and he will be with her in New Hampshire tomorrow. And he was asked, well, are you going to campaign for her a lot in the weeks ahead? And he said he was. So he will have to be used a lot because there's still a lot of, frankly, trust about her among millennials.
One of the things that Donald Trump needs to do, and Mitt Romney was very effective in this, was to capture college-age white Americans, and yet he has a significant deficit with Hillary Clinton in this regard. I don't get the sense that he was helped out by the debate last night. Does he need to sort of focus more on different issues to attract them?
Well, I think you're right. He did not gain any ground with that cohort last night. I think, first of all, he needs to really be better prepared for these kinds of debates. His strategy of making it up as I go along maybe works well as a in his previous debates and even his television experience. But last night it showed he was not, as time went on, a strong, well-prepared person to be president of the United States.
Both candidates had a mission last night, at least in my opinion. They needed to have a mission. One is Clinton to generate enthusiasm for her candidacy. I think it's fair to say there's been a lack of enthusiasm in her campaign. The other person, Donald Trump, needed to show that he's a capable leader, that he can lead the United States. Did either one accomplish their objective?
I think she is getting better. It is clear that the preparation paid off. As far as Trump was concerned, he again had moments which has attracted his supporters. But if you look at the span of 90 minutes and you really ask yourself, is he prepared to be president when he's never been elected, as George Aiken used to say, even a dog catcher? So he does not have that experience you need that I think is important to understand public sector governing.
Donald Trump has no illusions that he's going to win the African-American vote. In fact, he'll lose, and he'll lose badly. But the one objective that he does have, I believe, is that he needs to make sure they don't come out in the same, the African-American vote doesn't come out in the same numbers and enthusiasm as they did in 2008 with Barack Obama and 2012 with Barack Obama. Is he making any inroads in that regard, and is Clinton effectively countering him?
I think that he has not yet made any convincing case to black Americans that he would be a better choice. Whether or not Hillary has completely made the sale, I think, remains to be seen. I guess I, at the end of the day, do not think that she will have the enthusiasm on with those voters that Barack Obama had.
What was the most effective tactic that Clinton deployed last night, and what was the most effective tactic that Trump deployed?
Well, I think let's start with Trump. He started out, as you would expect, as being very aggressive. And that seemed, on the trade issue, that seemed to, at first, put her back on her heels a bit. But he did not sustain it. I thought her best moments were when she very much let him talk a lot, and then she was able to demonstrate by her responses, and especially on the women's issue at the end, that she has what it takes to stand up to his bullying tactics.
In 2012, we all remember this, the first debate, and by all consensus, it seemed that everybody believed that President Obama mailed that debate in, and Mitt Romney, it was on economic issues, and Mitt Romney scored a very convincing debate performance that night. Ironically, the president came back in the next two debates. So can Donald Trump recover from a bad debate?
Yes, and will he? Will he spend the kind of new strategy that he needs, which is basically to prepare? And the next one will be really questions from the audience, It's more of a town meeting format. We have seen that that's a very different venue. On the other hand, I think one of the things I like to mention is that in this election season, we've seen a fundamental shift in the way journalism deals with liars. You know, the rules for many years, and when I was managing editor and generations of journalists, you would not, as a journalist, call out or say X, Y. The old view was you would say X said this on this day and this on the next day. That has changed. Now you have seen, especially in the last several weeks, major newspapers or media outlets absolutely saying Donald Trump has lied. I'm wondering what that kind of media coverage in the next 40 days, how that will impact voters.
You know, what's interesting, Steve, is that if you look at poll results, I think the press is just above Putin in terms of popularity.
That's true.
Doesn't it sort of fall into that scenario that they're taking sides on this issue if that is the case?
I know that that's the allegation, and you can make a case about that, but at some point, I think voters deserve the views of people who have followed these campaigns extremely closely to help them sort out what is true and what is not true. Now, it's not that only Donald Trump is having this problem, as so is Mrs. Clinton. But I think as we saw last night, or at least the analysis I saw overnight, his misstatements were more than hers.
Let's go to the moderator, Lester Holt. How do you think he did?
I thought he did an okay job, Mike. I thought that, and it just goes to the issue I just talked about. Near the end, when he pushed back on Donald Trump on his Iraq war position, he was not strident. I thought that he did the best thing he did was basically let the candidate speak without a lot of interference by him. I think he did. I would give him a strong B for his performance.
Yeah, I thought he did a fairly good job on that. I mean, oftentimes, and I saw, you know, some of the Twitter universe about this, he needs to be stronger, he needs to go after Trump, he needs to go after Clinton. But that's not the moderator's job. It's the opponent's job to go after the individual that's saying the wrong thing or perceived to be saying the wrong thing.
Yes,
isn't
it is. And that, for the most part, that's what he was.
Let me turn to state politics, and let's go to the governor's race, because that's sort of what will be at the top of the ticket usually is what impacts the governor's race somewhat, and we'll see how it impacts it this year. But what is your read in terms of the governor's race and the impact the presidential race may have on it here in Vermont?
Well, at the moment, of course, we haven't seen any public polls, Mike, but at the moment, I still think that that Phil Scott may have a small lead, but I am really focused on two things. One is that, as we've talked before, about turnout. But, you know, turnout doesn't happen automatically. The state Democratic Party, with funding from many sources nationally, Senator Leahy, Congressman Welch, they've got 11 field offices throughout the state. And they are working the phones almost every moment of the day trying to identify and get voters to vote. The other is this is an open race in Vermont, and it is a nationally it's been described as a toss-up, which I think is accurate. I have noticed in the last week or so the conversation between Phil Scott and Sue Minter is getting sharper and more pointed. So I think, especially on the tax issue, so I think the national race and gender issues in Vermont really, at the moment, I think I would say is putting Sue on what I would describe as a path towards victory.
Thank you, Steve. Terry, thank you for your time.
I thank you very much. How many times can I say thank you?
This is Open Mic, and we've been speaking with Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst. When we come back, your phone calls. Who won the debate last night? What were some of the pertinent aspects of that debate that you think are important for us to discuss? This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In this segment, I'd like to get your opinions. Share your opinions on what you thought of the debate last night. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. You heard from two experts already. Got a bunch in the pile of what newspapers are saying throughout the country. It's your opinion that I'm most interested in. 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Ruth in Sheldon. Ruth, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning. What I saw and heard was Lester Holt giving Hillary more time than Donald Trump. He couldn't stop her from talking. She was very pushy. Some people say she was well prepared, but I thought she was very pushy. And what I saw was Donald Trump using great restraint. And Lester Holt always tried, he kept saying, speed it up or stop to Donald Trump. But he didn't do that to Hillary. And when he tried to, she just wouldn't stop. And we started timing her responses right from the beginning. And she always went over 2 minutes. So I would give Lester Holt a D minus, and we like him. We thought he would be a good moderator, but I don't think he was fair at all.
Thanks,
and
Ruth.
That's my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. We're talking about the debate. Who won the debate? What was your opinions on the debate? And any other sort of pertinent information about the debate that you think is important to share? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Michael in Berrytown. Michael, you're on Open Mic.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
I thought that an important part of that discussion last night was where Clinton accused him of stiffing a number of his workers that had performed a variety of work on his different projects. And rather than defend himself and deny it, he said that maybe he wasn't happy with their work, which, again, I think was an indication of the kind of character that guy is. We've heard about the bankruptcies. They've been numerous. And telling us how he treated people that were doing work for him, I think is really quite illuminating into the overall character of the guy. What do you think?
Well, I thought that was an interesting portion of the debate. I do think that he did come back and say that that there are tens of thousands of employees that are happy and those sort of things, and he was talking about how that dispute. I don't know if that struck me the same way it did you, Michael, but if it struck you that way, then it's important that he bone up on that issue, because it means that it has an impact. And I think, you know, those are sort of the things. I think overall Donald Trump did not do a good job last night. I don't think he convinced people that he's ready for the presidency of the United States. By the way, I'm not sure that Hillary Clinton also sealed the deal last night. So we'll see, Michael. So thank you for your phone call. We're taking phone calls today on what did you think about the debate. Number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Mike in Northfield. Mike, you're on open mic.
Hi there, Mike. Hey, your first guest insulted me and I think a whole lot of us. There's a lot of us out here, older white men who never went to college, but we're not dumb. And we, I mean, he just insulted me, and it made me very angry. I am not a Trump supporter. I don't think that he has any business trying to be the president. He doesn't pay his bills, and he doesn't pay taxes, and I just don't think he's very patriotic. And I'm a veteran, and he's insulted a lot of us veterans as well.
Yeah, so, Mike, let me just sort of it may have been to a question that I asked Eric, and I want to be fair to Eric on this because it was a question that I asked. And I said that Donald Trump has not gathered the support of college-educated white voters that Mitt Romney did in 2012. Mitt Romney was way ahead of Barack Obama in that. Did I indicate anything? I want to make sure because I have the greatest respect for people that didn't go to college. I want to make sure I didn't insult anybody on this.
No, you didn't. He did. He said older white males, for the most part, go for Donald Trump. I don't believe that, and I think it's an insult to all of us who didn't go to college.
Yeah, but the poll, let me just, in somewhat of defense, Mike, the polls do indicate that older white non-college voters are going to Donald Trump. Was there something else that I just want to make sure here?
No, that I think that poll is wrong. I don't believe hardly any of these stupid polls anyway. Every time I get a call and they're polling me, I hang up on them. Because they ask the questions so that they get the answer that they want. They don't ask you for your opinion. They ask you in a pointed way, do you believe such and such or whatever, and they ask it so that they get the answer that they want. And I think a lot of them, when they get the answer they don't want, they just throw that out.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you very much. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, you're on open mic. Did you think Donald Trump won?
No, I didn't think Donald Trump won. It was a debate, and whether there was a winner or loser, I don't know. It depends on who's scoring and how you want to score. So, personally, I wasn't looking at this from a winner or loser. I actually hadn't intended to watch it, but then I stayed up and I said, what the heck? And to some degree, I was pleasantly surprised because it was an interesting juxtaposition to put those two side by side. And I think Trump's hit his ceiling simply because he's got no more people to appeal to than who he already appeals to. Clinton, on the other hand, and when you talk about like the millennials and the younger folks, when they get around to one of these debates, they're going to get around to the issue of the environment, global warming, et cetera. They're going to talk about women's rights and women's ability to control their own bodies. That's where Hillary Clinton gets to really speak to the millennials, because that's where she's going to speak to issues that are near and dear to their heart, and they are very concerned. These folks, especially when you get into their 20s and their 30s, and I feel comfortable saying this from having some discussions with my own daughter, who's in her early 20s, about this and what her and her friends think and talk about and when they do talk about these issues. And Trump's not going to be able to appeal to them under any circumstances. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, can. So Hillary Clinton has a path to appeal to more voters. And what I think was interesting from listening to Trump last night, he's reached his nadir. He has nobody more to appeal to. All he can do is stiffen up his base and hope they turn out to vote.
Thanks, Rama. I mean, did anybody have the same sort of impression that I did about the debate? I was sort of underwhelmed by both. And I guess that may be the sort of overriding feeling that I got, that here you have the two most unpopular presidential candidates in modern history. And I don't know if they, you know, look, one did better than the other. I mean, Hillary Clinton went after Donald Trump and he didn't have great answers. But I was underwhelmed with what some of the solutions were that Hillary Clinton was talking about it. And, you know, there's an opening there for Donald Trump. And he didn't take it. He didn't take advantage of it last night because I think most people do not want the status quo. And then the more that Clinton comes off as the status quo, the more it will turn off people like the millennials. Here's the problem that Donald Trump last night did. He was splaining a lot. He seemed to be explaining, and I know I'm saying splaining instead of explaining, but what was he was splaining about his company. He was splaining about his tax returns. He was splaining about different things he said in politics. And by the way, when you're splaining in politics, you're losing. And he was doing a lot of splaining last night. In fact, you know, Donald Trump had, as I said earlier, Donald Trump had Hillary Clinton on her heels in the beginning of the debate, but she turned that around on him fairly quickly. And he seemed to lose interest and lose focus in where he was going. That status quo line is something that can resonate with the American public. You saw it with Bernie Sanders. And to some extent, you saw it with Donald Trump in the primary. But this is not the primary. This is the general election. You have to expand your voter base here. Or you have to diminish or keep the voter base of your opponent from expanding. And last night, I don't think Donald Trump did that. Let's go to John in Burlington. John, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Mike. I laugh when you phrase your question, the way you phrase your questions often, such as the one today, did Donald Trump win? Nobody anywhere thinks he won. Nobody. But that's beside the point. The fact that he wasn't prepared, I don't think, is the issue. If I could use an example from the school setting, you can't cram for a final exam if you haven't done your work for the whole semester. We have a man in Donald Trump who has no experience in the political arena. He has never held an office. The comments he made last night were dangerous, where he, for example, on the foreign policy issues, where he's threatening to break treaties that we have with our allies. And if I was the head of another country, I would be very worried to have Donald Trump at the head of our government. And my hope is that Gary Johnson will realize that Trump is so dangerous for the United States that he will actually encourage his followers to continue pushing the libertarian issues, but in this election, to vote that so that Donald Trump is not elected. We don't want another Ralph Nader issue that elected George W. Bush.
Thanks, John, for your opinion. Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Paul, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. A couple of comments. First of all, I don't think any of the candidates swayed anybody outside of their own their base. And that if you like Trump or you're leaning towards Trump, Hillary came off weak at first. She did definitely pick up towards the end of things. If you like Hillary or you're leaning towards her, Trump came off a little bit as a bully. In regards to the debate itself and some of the stats that I saw on New York Times and other websites, it appears that Trump interrupted Hillary 29 times and she interrupted him 9. As far as talking goes, it actually was pretty even, according to what I read, and somewhere around 43, 44 minutes of speaking by Donald and 41 and change for Hillary. So as far as those stats go, it looks fairly even. I think the loser here was Lester Holt. He couldn't control Donald. Donald, did interrupt those 29 times. And more importantly, when you talk about explaining things, the reason Donald had to was because he was fact-checked 5 times by Lester Holt. Hillary was not fact-checked once. And you look at the issues that Lester Holt asked of Donald Trump, it was all the same old issues, you know, in regards to his, you know, his failures and some of, you know, the controversies that Donald's created. Hillary was not asked once about her emails, Benghazi, or her penchant for lying. So he did have to kind of explain because he kept getting asked those questions, I think, Mike.
Thanks, Paul. Thank you for your opinion. You know, one of the things that, look, I know that being a moderator is a tough job. And you know, we did four debates at the Tunbridge Fair. And one of the things that you sort of wrestle with as a moderator is when to interrupt and when not to interrupt. And I think that is a question that, you know, lingers from moderator to moderator. One of the things that I did, and I told both people that were participating in the debate and the radio audience, that I was not going to be the fact checker for the various candidates. That duty was fully on the candidates themselves. If another candidate was not telling a fact right, then that candidate needed to correct that person. You know, Lester Holt, that's a tough job when you have two people that want to be president of the United States that want to get everything in. So, you know, I give him credit for doing it. I don't think it's a – look, I don't think that's a win-win situation for Lester Holt. I think people are going to be angry at him from one side or the other, and it's going to be interesting. So we're talking about presidential debates. Tom, let's hold up on the phone calls. We really don't have time. I'll try to come back later in the program to talk about this debate last night. What I was interested in, though, is sort of Politico does something that I think is really interesting. They get a bunch of people, both Republicans, independents, and Democrats together to discuss, you know, these various issues, who won the debate, and roughly 80% last night, and this is equal number of Republicans and Democrats responding to this post-debate survey, said that Hillary Clinton did a better job at the debate. We'll keep discussing that. Really looking forward in the second hour. We're going to be talking about Leland Kinsey. He's a seventh-generation Vermonter who died in the beginning part of September. He wrote so beautifully about Vermont, including its nature and our people and our state. Dee Dee Cummings will be joining us. She is the publisher of Leland's poetry, and she'll join us to talk about who Leland Kinsey was and why it's important for us to know about him. And then if we get some time, I'll open back up. We have a lot of phone calls. A lot of people want to come call in and discuss debate. We'll do that. And, of course, we'll check in with our friends at Talk Media News because, well, we'll probably talk debates, I guess, is what we're going to be talking about. So in the meantime, this is Open Mic. And you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. You got it. We're celebrating the future. 85 years WDEV News Radio. WDEV AM 550 broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier. 96.1 FM from Warren. 96.5 FM from Barrie. 98.3 FM from Montpelier. And serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, guess what? We're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com, and you can listen to the Open Mic podcast anytime at your convenience. We'll be right back. This is Mike Smith. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We will turn again to the debate and talk with our colleague at Talk Media News live from New Jersey because he was at the debate last night, Luke Vargas. Luke, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
One of the things that I'm always amazed about is when I watch these debates, I've always called it for someone else other than Donald Trump, even in the primaries. And yet, a couple days later when the poll results come out, his poll numbers have gone up. Do we expect that to happen after this debate?
It could. I just am not convinced anymore, and I have to defend this position every time I state it, but I don't think the polls are really what is going to decide this. I mean, of course, if they shift in a dramatic way, it should give Clinton, the Clinton campaign, get them nervous. But I mean, really, at this point, I'm looking at this race, and it's about, on the Clinton side, getting young people excited to go out and vote, which is going to make the difference here. They're not in the polls. They're not represented in the polls. The other two pillars of the Democratic constituency are women and minorities are often represented well in polls, but young people, and they will drive turnout and make this either a success for Hillary Clinton or a failure, I think are not captured by those polls. So yeah, sure. I think Donald Trump lost last night. I'm not necessarily convinced that means his polling numbers aren't going to rise even. the American public has a weird way to always confound us folks up in the Northeast who think we understand politics pretty well, but the rest of the country doesn't always see things the same way. But I really think behind the scenes, Hillary Clinton did a much better job of achieving what she needed to last night, which is to make people in their mid-20s, early 30s, voting for the first time, make them care, appeal to them. I mean, she had a lot of tasks, and I think she did quite a stand-up job at, you know, getting people excited again. And at Strategic Times, I think pointing out at least what her campaign will call sort of the bullying tendencies of Donald Trump. That's a big part of what will drive youth turnout, is the fact that you need to go out there and stand up for someone who is under an unfair attack, and that attacker is inherently unfit for the job. Whether that's true or not is up for debate, but I think Hillary Clinton made an argument to her young supporters that their input in this election matters, and I think that has a lot more to do with the outcome in November than, I don't know, the tracking poll that comes out in a few days.
One of the things that, from my perspective at least, Hillary Clinton needed to do was to generate some enthusiasm about her campaign. There seems to be, well, it isn't the same enthusiasm that you got, for example, from Bernie Sanders' campaign, where people were enthusiastic about it. Donald Trump, on the other hand, had a different mission. He had to show that he's capable to run the country. Did either of them meet their objectives?
It's funny. I mean, I think they both did things successfully. I don't know if they really accomplished all they set out to. I will say I think Clinton did more of what she wanted because the spin that she had going into the debate, or that her campaign had, continued on very smoothly after the debate. And I know those are all pre-crafted narratives. They have, depending on how the debate goes, different lines they're going to tell their surrogates to go out there and circulate in the press afterward. But I think she did a good enough job that they said, all right, we don't need to do much damage control tonight. We didn't have, on the Clinton side, you know, the equivalent of Giuliani's out there saying, oh, he didn't have a great night, maybe this will be his last debate. There wasn't a lot of second guessing. I saw the way that the Trump campaign managed expectations to the press yesterday, saying, look, yeah, I mean, Hillary Clinton was practicing for 2 weeks, and we thought it was more important to be out there with the American people doing rallies for those 2 weeks. If that's the best spin you have after preparing for this event for that long, I think that's an indication, an admission from the Trump campaign that didn't go exactly how they wanted it to. At least on the spin front, which is always sort of a fun thing for me to measure, I think the fact that Hillary Clinton's folks were talking the same sort of lines leaving the debate hall as they were going into it means that their candidate delivered along the lines of items that they wanted her to better than Donald Trump did.
It's on to St. Louis for the next debate in about 2 weeks. What do they what do they have to accomplish in that debate?
That's an interesting one. I mean, one thing I really took away from this debate is that, peppered in with, I think, some unforced errors and you know, areas of this debate where he just wasn't helping himself all that much, maybe not goofing or really having any gaffes, but Donald Trump is still really strong, I think, on trade and in the sort of emotional way in which he diagnoses the failing of American infrastructure. Now, putting aside whether or not he or Hillary Clinton is better equipped to change these things, I still think this is a very important thing. I mean, people talk often about the 2008 election, and we look back on it and we talk about it as sort of a foreign policy referendum. This really irritates me when people say, you know, the major thing people wanted in 2008 was to get out of our foreign wars. And that was a high priority item for Democrats and independents alike. But if you go and look at the Pew polls and a Gallup poll that are taken in the week before the 08 election, McCain is winning quite handily on foreign policy. It's Obama that was able to win on convincing people that he could fix the economic crisis. And more people cared about that, and his margin was greater. And so even though it's a small element of these speeches, when he's talking about how, oh, go to Qatar and look at how nice their roads are, go to China, look how nice their railways and bridges are, and then you come here and it's a third world country, that may have been 90 seconds of the debate. But the fact that Trump still is so strong that he's able to, it's maybe not a vision for the future, but it is a diagnosis of the ills of current American society. And I think his, you know, Clinton's inability to wiggle away from his attacks on free trade, a small part of the debate time-wise, but resonant issues that I think Hillary Clinton needs to find a way to neutralize, because it may seem small, but I think they weigh very heavily on the minds of voters. And if you cannot really reduce his appeal there, this race is going to be needlessly close for Hillary Clinton.
I sort of agree with you. I thought he had her on her heels in the first 20 minutes of the debate, strictly on foreign trade and trade issues and the agreements that America has entered into in trade agreements. One of the things I'm just curious, we got about a minute left, Luke. How do you think Lester Holt did?
I think he did pretty well. It's a difficult task. I will point out, Donald Trump said he thought Lester Holt did a good job, because if you fired up Drudge this morning, which I do for my opposition research, the first two headlines were about how he was the third debater. We really overstepped his bounds. It's worth pointing out that the Trump campaign has been full of misinformation about Holt and seemed to be excited to jump at whatever opportunity they had to criticize him. Trump was calling him a registered Democrat last week, when in fact he was a registered Republican the last time he was a registered voter. So, that's to be expected. I think that criticism would come from their camp, but I thought he did a pretty knock-up job, and I'm glad we're dealing with Lester Holt and not Matt Lauer.
Luke, thank you so much for joining us today, and get some sleep.
I will do. Thanks so much.
Luke Vargas from Talk Media News. Coming up, we'll talk about the life of Leland Kinsey, who was a Northeast Vermont Kingdom poet. And I think it's important that you know who Leland Kinsey was, because he spoke about us as Vermonters. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my great pleasure to welcome on the phone to the Open Mic program Dee Dee Cummings. She is Green Writers Press publisher and a literary agent, and she is the publisher of Leland Kinsey, who I want to introduce to those people who don't know him, because he had a great influence, a great ability to capture Vermont. Good morning, Dee Dee. Mm-hmm.
Hi, Mike. I'm glad to be on your show.
Who is Leland Kinsey, and why are his works important?
Leland Kinsey, who just passed away last week, was a Vermont poet of extraordinary talent, and he was a quiet poet. And Howard Frank Mosier, the Vermont novelist who many people have heard of, and great friend of Leland Kinsey, said he was the unofficial poet laureate of the state of Vermont. And that's kind of the way he was. He was a poet who really taught us so much about this great state that we live in, about the mountains and the streams and the flora and the fauna especially, but also the people who inhabit Vermont, from, you know, the earliest settlers to the native peoples up to the more modern day concerns. I mean, there's one poem where he talks about having a garden, but all his kids have grown and left home, and he doesn't want to sell it at the farmer's market because he doesn't like to talk to people. So great. And he kind of captures this Vermont way of life. And, you know, he was a bit, in his writing, it could be a bit cantankerous, you know, but he will be greatly missed. And he wasn't very old. He was only 65, but he had a great life.
As you mentioned, Howard Frank Mosier was a good friend of his, actually was a teacher of his at one point, and recognized Leland's gift in high school. Actually, I think it was his wife, Howard Frank Mosier's wife, who recognized his gift. Was he that talented? And did you recognize those gifts?
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mention that because Howard's wife, Phyllis, is amazing. I mean, she's the one, as you mentioned, she said to Howard, boy, he should be teaching you, you know, because Howard, I didn't realize this, but Howard taught Leland in high school in St. Albans, but also at UVM as when Leland was an undergrad. And as far as his talent, I had heard of Leland Kinsey, and I've been living in Vermont since college, which, you know, that's a long time now, almost 30 years I've been here. And I had heard of him because I was a poetry major at Middlebury College, but we really focused on, you know, the canon of the sort of great, the dead white male canon of poetry as opposed to modern poets. You know, we focused on, you know, Yeats and Stevens and all of that. And so getting into contemporary poetry, I was kind of late to that. And Howard really introduced me to Leland because when I started the publishing company now almost 3 years ago, one of the first books I published was Leland Kinsey's sixth volume of poetry. He'd already been published widely before, and it was called Winter Ready. And Howard said, Dee Dee, publish this book. And you know what I said? I said, okay, and I didn't even read the book yet. You know, I hadn't even read it. I just said, okay, because, you know, he's Howard Frank Mosier, and he's one of my favorite writers, and he's on my advisory board. And I said, great, I'm going to publish Leland Kinsey. And then I got the manuscript, and like, I just couldn't put it down. I read every poem over and over again, and they were really beautiful. He was brilliant. He went on for his master's at Syracuse, which is one of the top creative writing MFA programs in the country. And, you know, he really, really distinguished himself, and he could have gone on for PhD. He could have done the more traditional poetry track, but he chose to come back to Vermont and live on the family farm and work the land.
You know, one of the things that I sort of recognize as something that attracts me, at least, is that Kinsey never seemed to lose his Vermont roots. His poetry was grounded in Vermont. Is that the appeal of his poetry?
Well, I think it's the main, for me as a reader, it is one of my great loves is his Vermont writing. And there are a number of young writers coming up now in Vermont, like people like Julia Shipley, who writes criticism for 7 days, for example, and Sean Prentice, who's a professor at St. Michael's College. These younger writers are turning to Leland Kinsey. And, you know, I think he's just going to become more and more famous, you know, posthumously. And that's fine with Lee. You know, he was so mellow. He didn't really seek fame the way a lot of us do. You know, I'm putting myself in there because I'm a poet and I have a book coming out in April, which maybe I'll come back on your show. But I'm, like, promoting my book like crazy, you know, and that's what you kind of have to do in the world of publishing. But Leland Kinsey was really old school, and he didn't do that. He just wrote, and he did the requisite. You know, he set up his readings and books with bookstores and libraries and took care of all the business of poetry, but he set it aside, you know. And he really wrote beautifully about Vermont, and that's what I think people are looking to now. However, I think our listeners should know that he also wrote other books that took him away from Vermont. He took him up, some of his work took him to Canada, but there was a very important book called In the Rain Shadow, which is set entirely in Africa.
What motivated him to write? I ask people like Howard Frank Mosier, why do you write? And what motivated Leland to write?
Oh my goodness, this is a really, really good question. I would have to say, you know, in my conversations with Leland Kinsey, it was to really impart the world that he inhabited to his reader and to bring the reader into that world to inhabit it with him and share it. Does that make sense? You know, because he lived up on the farm up in the kingdom, and, you know, was really out in the woods and the boonies, and would walk the fields, and, you know, was really kind of a loner in a lot of ways. And, you know, he told me once that he would read the new poems that he was working on out loud to himself and make corrections. And his voice, I just have this image of him sitting alone and reading, and his voice was remarkable. He had this absolutely beautiful cadence and loud oratorial voice, but it was like he never needed a microphone. That was our big joke, you know, because I'd say, oh, should we set up a podium and a microphone? And he'd say, nope, don't need that.
He had this this hint of a Vermont accent that was charming.
It was huge.
I was trying to be generous.
He had the best Vermont accent. And, you know, it's really sad. We were in the process of doing an audiobook for Winter Ready. But he was really busy at the end of his life and very fulfilled with his work, because about a year ago, I bugged him. I said, look, it's about time that we publish a big, thick collection of your work. And he was very flattered. You know, he's so modest. And that's what's amazing about him. And I said, yeah, you are a poet, a very established poet in Vermont, and a poet of the entire New England region. And it's really important to have new and selected works by Leland Kinsey, because people that at his age and stature, I thought that would be really a great honor. And this was before he got sick. He almost died in April of, you know, the prior year. So he made a remarkable comeback, and, you know, was treated with chemo and a stem cell transplant, and he had a very good quality of life right up until the end. You know, he got to work on his book that I offered to publish, and he named it Galvanized, which I thought was perfect. And someone said, why? And I said, well, you know, it really, to me, it exemplified that sort of tough Vermont life, the living with, you know, sugar on snow and gathering sap with buckets and, you know, just machinery and driving a tractor and just the idea of galvanized, you know, but also the strength that comes through with that name. And he was very pleased with the name Galvanized. And then I created a book cover that has him on the tractor, and he just looking right into the camera, and the backdrop is all of snowy Vermont winter, and he's got all the snow piled up in the tractor, and he's bringing it down to the sugar house. I thought that was great.
I don't know Leland, but what I do know of him is his love for teaching, his love for Vermont, his love for poetry, fishing, farming. I'm going to ask you an unfair question. Which does he love most?
Oh, my gosh, his family. Oh my, he was so proud of his kids and his wife, Leslie. And I would say the love of family and the land. You know, it's getting kind of sentimental here, but, you know, there was this quote from Aeschylus that I remember from college. I can't remember it. So the love this family bears toward the land will bloom in human strength from age to age. Isn't that gorgeous?
Mm.
And that's the way he was, you know. He worked the land, and he was a good neighbor. He was a good farmer. He was a loyal husband and a father and just a hardworking guy. And he approached his poetry like work, you know. And like many Vermonters, he had three or four different jobs, you know. Like, I wear three or four hats just to make ends meet down here in Brattleboro. you know, that's what you have to do. You can't really have some people have corporate jobs in Vermont, as you know. And people have different life. Everyone has a different lifestyle. But many Vermonters really work different jobs, and he exemplified that. You know, he was he worked for Elder Hostel. He led tours. Let me pull up. Of course, I'm prepared. I have his bio sitting here. He was a farmhand, a printer, and a horse trainer.
I think that's great. And, you know, I mean, I can't imagine him sitting in a, you know, in a corporate office, or, you know, I think of him out in the field. And the Burlington Free Press did a big profile on him, and the, and I guess the reporter, Sally Pollack, she had to, you know, follow him around in the field, which was great. And the photographer came up, and, you know, and he showed off, you know, the land.
And his reading was about an Air Force jet crash that he did, right?
Oh, that is an amazing poem, don't you think?
I thought it was.
Yeah, that really happened. And, you know, another poem, it's like one of his ancestors was skinny dipping in a brook when the train went by carrying Queen Elizabeth. Boys were off skinny dipping, and I can imagine the Queen in the train with the royal wave, you know, going by. And you can find a lot of humor in his poems if you read them. And believe me, when I was publishing and designing, you know, working on Galvanized, New and Selected Poems by Leland Kinsey, I read the poems. It's 400 pages long, this book, and we're so proud of it because it's out. It came out in April, and Leland was very strong and fit at that point. And then he toured with the book. His last reading was in July at Bookstock in Woodstock, Vermont, which is a wonderful book festival. Mm-hmm. And I went down to hear him. Sorry, I went up to hear him up to Woodstock, and he read in a church behind a pulpit and with a microphone. And he really was like a preacher up there, you know. It was very, very, and I teased him about it afterwards. And he looked great then and was so in the moment and proud and happy about having this 400-page book published. So that makes me feel good.
Dee Dee, I got to take a break. I want to come right back. When I come back, I want to talk about sort of your decision to publish Winter Ready, because I find this fascinating how an author sort of comes to, a poet comes to you and talk about it. And also I want to focus on his love of nature as well. But we'll be right back. We're speaking with Dee Dee Cummings. She's Green Writers Press publisher and literary agent. And she was the publisher of Leland Kinsey, who died earlier this month. Great poet, great Vermonter. Want to introduce you to Leland Kinsey because his writings are so beautiful about our state, so beautiful about our people. When we come back, more with Dee Dee Cummings. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Now I want to return to talking with Dee Dee Cummings, Green Writers Press publisher and the publisher of poet Leland Kinsey. Dee Dee, Leland's focus on nature was particularly meticulous, I guess is the word, in his writings. Was he very familiar with the subject of nature and plants and birds and all those other things?
Oh, yes. I mean, especially Vermont's Northeast Kingdom. He knew it so well, you know. And I think of him, he was a poet of both place and people. And, you know, his work was really imbued with the knowledge of the land and the respect for the land. And I think that really comes through when you read his work, because there are so many terms I had to look up about the land that were, or names of berries and fruits and, you know, living off the land. I mean, he was the poet who really did that. You know, he didn't feign, like, you know, he didn't pretend to know the land. He really knew it. And, you know, Edward Hoagland, hadn't heard of him, but he is a critic and American essayist, novelist as well, and really praised Leland Kinsey's writing and said Leland was, quote, the genuine article. I thought that was a great quote. You know, and I know that Lee was very pleased to have the praise of someone like Edward Hoagland, you know, who's a, you know, a really well-known essayist and nature writer as well. So the genuine article. And that's kind of the way I think of Leland, you know. And his deep reverence for nature comes through pretty much in every single poem. And lately, I've been thinking of a poem he wrote in Winter Ready
that stayed with me because it just captures that fall light, which I see now a lot. I've been thinking about that poem. It's titled Fall Light. And he just had this ability to observe the world around him and make it universal, which is the true task of a writer and the true success of the poet, especially to use metaphor and language to impart meaning and to make it universal. He did it.
One of the things that you had mentioned earlier, that Howard Frank Mosier, it sort of introduced you to Leland mm-hmm. Kinsey. But after you read his manuscript, it was winter ready, right? That you
yes,
read?
That's the first one I read. I did read it, yes. I mean, I said yes without reading it, which I think is quite funny.
But when you read it, what grabbed you?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. His ability to make me travel with him, his ability to kind of bring the natural world to light in a way that I've just never seen before. And, you know, I love the Vermont poets that came before Leland Kinsey. I just, you know, people like Galway Canal, Hayden Carruth, you know, other writers who really were great writers of the land and the people, and they wrote about the farmers and the apple trees and the hard life in Vermont, but also the beauty that you find here. And Lee really is rooted in that tradition of following these great poets, you know, and same with Robert Frost, you know, who, you know, really became the biggest name in poetry in, you know, starting in the 1950s and into the 60s. I mean, Robert Frost made a living as a poet, which I think that was very unusual back then. A lot of poets like Wallace Stevens, you know, sold insurance, for example. You know, it's hard to make a living as a poet. Mm-hmm. And I think Lee is rooted in that tradition of writing, not just about nature, but about this universal meaning of life. And that's what really hit me with Winter Ready, because the book, and I helped him sequence it just a little bit. Honestly, like, Lee's work needed very little editing. You know, I mean, we had a big joke because he spelled Caesar wrong, and I caught that, and I was, you know, he thought that was really funny. We went back and forth by email about that, but, you know, his work was perfect, really, and he tinkered with it just a little bit, but when it came to me, I thought it was amazing. And the opening poem is, it has the poet literally perched on top of a chimney, and he's pointing the chimney. And, you know, that's a very specific task. It's hard work, and it sets the stage for what's to come in the book, because I imagine the poet on top of the chimney. He's looking around at the world, his farm, his house. He's working. He's getting the house ready for winter, you know, literally, you know, up on top of the world. And then the book travels. Each poem takes you deeper and deeper into the land, the people. There's one poem in there called Picking Stone. He literally is out working and turning over garden. But not only that, there's a deeper meaning, because he's helping a neighbor, another farmer, who is also his cousin, who's dying of cancer. And this poem is just so layered and deep and beautiful. And that's for me, that's why I read poetry, because it's not easy to read poetry. It takes work. But Leland's work is very accessible. You don't have to have a master's or a PhD in English literature to read his poetry. You know, it's accessible. Yeah. And I find in Winter Ready, that's one of his most Vermont books, in my opinion.
As you mentioned, in the spring, he released a collection called Galvanized, New and Selected yeah. Poems of Leland Kinsey.
Mm-hmm.
You also, as I was reading, getting ready for this interview, he has a new book of poetry coming out, doesn't he?
Wow. I haven't read it yet, Mike, and I'm so glad you mentioned that, because Howard Leland told me he was working on his best work ever. And, you know, Leland was not prone to hyperbole. I'm the one who does all that. I'm the promoter, you know. He said, In July, we chatted in Woodstock. He said, this is my best work. And I just I looked him right in the eye and I said, it's great. I want to publish it. And but we didn't have a contract or anything. I just said, send it to me. And he didn't. He was still working on it right up until he died. And he was working on it in the hospital. And, you know, when he was recovering, you know, from chemo and stem cell, he was working on it all last year. And Howard was able to tell Leland really literally just a few days before he died that we had decided that we would publish this book. And Howard said it brought me a lot of happiness at the end of his life. And, I mean, that kind of immortality is what we all seek. And it's so beautiful that we were able to give this great poet this kind of peace at the end of his life. And and here's another, you know, book of Lee's poetry. I haven't even read it. I already said yes. I trust Howard in you know, implicitly here, and Howard has read quite a bit of the work, and so Howard and I will organize it and sequence it and bring it out through Greenwriters Press.
We lost a poet on Sunday, David Budbill.
I know.
And are we losing talented poets in this state, or are there other ones coming up that you can sort of introduce us to?
Oh, what a nice question. I love that. And you should know, Mike, that David Budbill contacted me completely out of the blue about a year ago and said, I want you to publish my book, Broken Wing. And that was another poet I just said yes without. I said, oh, my gosh, David Budbill, I've been a long admirer. You know, I've admired his work for years. And we chatted on the phone for a long time. And so Broken Wing, it's a kind of a folk tale, and it's set in Vermont. It's an absolutely gorgeous work of fiction, and it's coming out in November. And again, I just feel like overwhelmed that these great poets and prose writers are. And David, he was also a playwright.
Mm-hmm. What?
And you know, they're leaving us. But David was really pleased, and I'm working with his daughter Nadine to bring the book out. So we're really, really sad by his death. And it was, you know, he was an amazing guy. You know, he was always out in the woods and just loved nature. Yet another incredible Vermont nature writer we've lost. But there are people coming up. You know, it's really interesting that you asked that, because I was a big fan of Ruth Stone. Do you remember Ruth Stone?
No, I don't, actually.
Oh, she used to be on Vermont Public Radio all the time, and just a wonderful Vermont writer. I mean, she grew up, I think, originally in New York and was from away, as they say. But her daughter, Bianca Stone, is an up-and-coming young poet who lives in Brooklyn and also comes to Vermont. And I had the opportunity to meet Bianca through our new laureate, Chard Denord. Chard introduced me to Bianca, and she's in her 30s and really impressive. So I'm excited to read more of Bianca Stone. And I love that she's the daughter of Ruth Stone, you know, and that's exciting. We have some amazing poets who are in their prime right now in Vermont that people might be interested in. One of my absolute favorite poets is Ellen Bryant Voigt. Ellen is, you know, not a young poet now, but in her prime. I mean, she is she just won a MacArthur Genius Award last year. And I think Ellen is just one of the finest poets writing in the United States, and she's a Vermonter, which is great. I mean, she was born in the South, but she, you know, lived here, taught at Goddard College for many years, and she's really great. Other young poets who are coming up there are some great poets in the Woodstock area. Here down here in Brattleboro, and a number of poets up in Burlington. People who I'm thinking of right now are Partridge Boswell. How do you like that name? It's a great name.
It's a great Vermont name, it sounds like.
It's my favorite name ever, Partridge Boswell. Super nice guy.
younger. Well, he's younger than I am, so he's young, right? Because I'm in my late 50s, early 60s area right now. And Partridge Boswell, remember that name? He has a brand new book that just came out. Another young poet I mentioned earlier is Julia Shipley. Young working farmer. She's amazing. I love her new book, The Academy of Hay, H-A-Y. Julia Shipley, Partridge Boswell,
all those
terrific poets. There's a poet down here in Brattleboro. Well, I mentioned Verona Birch, who is one of my favorite Southern Vermont poets, one of my favorite American poets. Her name is Veranda Porch. And a young poet right on my road here in West Brattleboro, her name is Diana Whitby. She's got a book out called Wanting It, which is very, very evocative title. And her work is really gorgeous and lyrical and, I would say, rooted in nature. And, Vermont is just, it's not only the most beautiful state. I've lived out in the Pacific Northwest and everything, but I came home to Vermont. I grew up in Rhode Island. I love the coastal estuaries and the shore as well, but the mountains draw me, and I just think that the poets who live here are almost—it's just fertile. Like, you know, they've grown out of the land here, and I think that we have great traditions of poetry in the state of Vermont too. I mean, we have the Breadloaf Writers Conference, which was established in the 1930s by Robert Frost and Willa Cather, a great American writer. And so the founding of Breadloaf was really something that cemented Vermont as one of the leaders in the country for poetry.
DD, we are run out of time. I could go on for another hour. Just briefly, I got about 30 seconds. Where can we find the works of Leland Kinsey?
Wherever books are sold. I always tell people that we're Greenwriters Press, but we have, you know, we're in bookstores. You may have to ask for it, but the bookstore will order it and have it in a couple of days.
DD Cummings, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Also in libraries.
Okay.
Bye, Mike. Thank you.
Bye, DD. That's DD Cummings, Greenwriters Press publisher. When we come back, let's return to the debate. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I just want to sort of give you a round robin of what was in some of the newspapers today in the next 2 minutes, which is going to be quite hard to do. But if you looked at the Politico, they did an analysis with 90 people, I think it is. I don't have the particular number here. But 80% of their insiders, the swing state activists, and they have both equal number of Democrats and Republicans, responded to the post-debate survey. They said Clinton did a better job at the debate. If you go to the Wall Street Journal, the central question they say in this election is coming down to whether an American majority that wants change in direction is willing to take the risk on Mr. Trump to deliver it. It was still a question after Monday night. Winners and losers, the Washington Post, The Fix, winner Hillary Clinton, loser Donald Trump, winner Lester Holt, loser Donald Trump's website because it went down. Those sort of things. The audience was a loser, they said, because they interrupted. The New York Times said basically, look, the Republican field was whittled to the worst of the worst, which gave the debate its strange, potentially tragic dimension. The New York Post said it was a draw. It said that the first Clinton-Trump debate was roughly a draw, which is bad news for her because she needs to turn this race around, and she failed. A Trump column in the New York Post, you would presume that the New York Post is going to be pro-Trump, but this one said Hillary Clinton was boring and exceptionally well prepared. Donald Trump was exciting but embarrassingly undisciplined. It was quite a range of takes in terms of what the debate will produce. We'll find out in the days to come. I want to thank our guests, Eric Davis, Steve Terry, Talk Media News, Luke Vargas, and D.D. Cummins talking about the poet Leland Kinsey. And, of course, I want to thank all of you. A lot of phone calls. Tomorrow, Dave Moody from Motor Racing Network will be on. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you all for your phone calls. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.